He's a Toronto-based filmmaker and author with his newest book called Have You Eaten Yet? Stories from Chinese Restaurants Around the World. Chuck Kwan joining us on Canada Now. Hey, Chuck, good to meet you.
Good afternoon, Jeff.
Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. You have a 15-part documentary called Chinese Restaurants. How much did doing that inspire the book?
Pretty much everything. My book is basically a memoir of my travel and adventures while I spent 4 years filming my film series. So it's got a lot more tidbits, got a lot more in-depth analysis of the political and the cultural and the social situations that I touch upon on the film.
You know, it's interesting how food really tells a story.
That's right.
What does the food say about global Chinese migration? Like, do Chinese restaurants offer a lot of insight into history?
Yes, it does. Because everywhere the Chinese would disperse to, they would pick up a spatula and start cooking because that's the easiest profession they can get into, especially when you don't speak a language or you're not familiar with the culture or the society. So, but us, food is also representative of the kind of integration and change the Chinese have used to adapt to their own, to the new host country. For example, we have a lot of food that are unrecognizable in China, but there's certainly Chinese food in the host country. You know, we're talking about Jamaican Chinese food, American and Canadian Chinese food that are adaptive from the original cuisine.
Yet there are so many similarities. Like, I feel that there have been generations of Chinese immigrants that have been able to stay so true to their cultural identity no matter where they may have moved to.
Yes, that's fairly inherent in the sense that, you know, I count, for example, family values, respect for education, and also working hard and courageous and brave as some of these common characteristics of Chinese diaspora. And they're no different from, you know, other groups like the Jewish group, for example. But certainly food is a very distinctive element because everybody loves to have a bowl of rice or have a little dish of stir fry. So that gets also, it's also a very common denominator among the Chinese diasporic societies.
You link the personal stories of chefs and entrepreneurs and laborers and those dreamers who populate Chinese kitchens worldwide. How was it to sit down and to speak with them?
Well, I'm also a member of the diaspora. I grew up in three countries before I was 18. So I have a sense of empathy, and I could relate to the stories they tell us. And these people, many of them are refugees. They came out of China in the early century, or were born in that country out of refugee parents. And I touch upon that because the whole migration pattern right now is very evident with what we are facing today in this world. We had Syrian refugees, we have Afghan refugees, and now we have Ukrainian refugees. People had to flee their homeland because of famine, because of war, and because of poverty. So in that sense, what the Chinese have done is no different from what is happening in the world right now. And I find that very, very relevant. And the stories they tell us, the kind of racism they face, the kind of barriers to integration in the new society they face are just as relevant today as it was maybe 50 or 100 years ago.
And would these Chinese immigrants have found that opening a restaurant was an easier way to integrate into a new society?
That's right. And I always say that you don't have to speak the language. You can just cook your food and serve it without even speaking a word of English or French or Norwegian. So in that sense, it's a universal language. And before this, it's very communal in Chinese culture. And I think I'm happy that Chinese immigrants can bring that kind of elements into their new country and prosper while serving a delicious meal of Chinese cuisine.
Mm-hmm. Provides work for newcomers as well.
Exactly.
So I think,
and
yeah.
Some of them are maybe illegal as well. You know, throughout the ages, there have been a lot of illegal migrants, jumping off ships and coming through, with smuggling gangsters and whatnot. They find work because the Chinese restaurants welcome, cheap, quote unquote, cheap labor, but also there's a refuge for them to be able to work illegally for a while until their status get cleared.
Mm. When you travel, I've heard that you really crave Chinese food, like especially when you travel, and you'd find yourself asking many questions to the proprietor of a restaurant that you'd go to. Is that what got the ball rolling on all of this, on your documentary, of course, then the book? Is it because you have a propensity to do that you thought, well,
exactly,
I might as well be working. I might as well put something together.
I love to travel. After college, I travel everywhere. And in everywhere I went, I would always be craving for a good bowl of rice and some veggies, And I would go into a restaurant and I would just tell the owner or the chef, I said, don't give me anything on the menu. Just give me what you would normally eat, back home or in your kitchen. So this is the way how I started the conversation. And then from there on, I just asked them how they got here, what are their aspirations, what are the barriers, and what do they want for the future? What do they want for their children's future? As many of them do not want their kids to be taking over their restaurant. Basically, they just want their kids to be lawyers and doctors and engineers, never mind, cooking a Chinese meal for customers.
Mm. Well, I think that's, parents everywhere. You want your kids to earn more and work less and live a happier life. I think that's certainly universal. It speaks to, I think, how every parent wants it to be for their kids.
It's also a status thing, too. Chinese restaurant worker doesn't have this life status as a doctor, for example, unless you're a super, super chef. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I think the parents just want the children to leave, that profession.
Yeah. But you see, in my case, Chuk, like I've got two young kids and I'm a radio host, and it doesn't get any higher than radio host. So I don't know where they would go and what they would do.
They might be TV host.
No way. TV's got nothing on radio. With all the people that you ended up meeting, I'm curious about one in particular. I think you talk about him in the first chapter of your book. You talk about a man named Noisy Jim, who ran the New Outlook Cafe in Saskatchewan. And he did it for 40 years. People in town wanted him to be mayor. Tell us about him.
Right. Well, he came to Canada when he was 15 as a paper son, meaning that he had used somebody else's legal papers to come into Canada to a quote-unquote paper father. And he has stayed in Saskatchewan for 40, 50 years, ever since he immigrated. But he's such a gregarious fellow and, a joker and a man about town. Everybody loves him in town. And we're talking about a town of about 1,200 people. And they all come to the cafe, either for, after hockey practice or after cinema. They will hang out in this cafe, not necessarily eating, but it also became a community center for the town. And it's probably the only place open after 9 p.m. in that town. So in that sense, he really, really served the community. And because he talks so loud, people start calling him Noisy Jim. That's how he got his name.
Yeah, I love that. I love that, and I love how popular he would end up becoming.
Right,
just one of a few characters that you have highlighted in the book.
And I went to his funeral. I went to his funeral when the whole town came out, and the hockey team he sponsored came out as color guards. And you know, it's just very moving. It was a very moving scene to see how he's well respected and well loved.
Yeah, it's I love how much of a storyteller you are, and I mean, just Noisy Jim would be a book in and of itself. And you studied film production at New York University. What led you to become a storyteller in that way?
I think I've always been a storyteller. I only made one film in my life, and that was the film I made for Cannes Restaurant. I didn't start out to be a filmmaker. I wanted to make films to tell my stories. And I felt that there were enough stories around the Chinese diaspora, especially through the lens of a Chinese kitchen, that I could tell. And of course, the book is a kind of natural outflow. It's a very different format, but it allows me more room than just half an hour episode to deal with my stories and certainly allow me to expand on the kind of the topics that I touch upon in my film. Mm.
It feels as though you've spent your professional life wanting to tell stories that needed to be told, and making sure that the right information is out there. Like, you go back to 1978, you co-founded the Asianadian, a progressive and influential magazine that's dedicated to promotion of Asian Canadian arts and culture and politics. I want to know more about how that got started.
Well, it was a project that I got together with two other people. We thought that we need to tell our own stories. Meaning the Asian Canadian stories. And so, you know, you can say it's a bit of identity politics, but it's also an awakening of the Asian Canadian community back in the late 70s, where we're starting to find our own voice. And certainly that has roots in my loving to tell stories, because we want our stories to be heard. You know, from a history book perspective, you know, for example, like one of the stories I always wanted to tell is that Chinese railroad workers had a big influence on the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railroad. And even though they were their achievements were not even mentioned many times, but there was a lot of work that went on behind the building the railroad that was contributed by the Chinese. And some of these stories are forgotten, so I wanted to have that kind of platform to be able to tell these stories.
Absolutely. A year after, like we talk about 78, in 79... you helped lead the anti-W5 campaign to fight against the racist portrayal of Chinese Canadians on Canadian network television. Take us back to that time and ultimately what sparked that.
Well, the story came out of a news magazine by a Canadian television network, basically saying it's called Campus Giveaway, and it talks about campuses in Ontario and elsewhere. That had, you know, Asian faces going to classes and in either medical school or pharmacies, and the basic kind of questioning is: do these people belong? Are they Canadians? If they're not Canadians, then they shouldn't be wasting our taxpayers' money going to our university. It turned out that every face that they featured were either Canadians or naturalized citizens or immigrants. So we're dealing with a very racist kind of assumption that an Asian face is automatically a foreigner. And we wanted to kind of, neutralize that and also reverse that and you know, strongly stressing that, you know, Canada is a multicultural country. We have Asian faces, we have European faces, we have Black faces, we have Indian faces, and so forth. And that's what got started on that movement. We demanded the network to apologize for that unfortunate episode. And that got the Chinese Canadian National Council founded. It was an association across the country to unite the kind of, Chinese Canadians and give them a sense of, to fight for equal justice and equal rights in Canadian society.
Well, that was 43 years ago.
Right. And that was a long time ago, but it's certainly, the fight continues. I mean, it's gotten better these days, but certainly, we're every time, not the Chinese, but certainly somebody look at a South Asian faces and or a Arab face and say, well, do these people belong? Well, they do belong because they're immigrants into this country.
Well, and that's where I wanted to go, because it was 43 years ago. But how much have things changed for the better since then, considering how long it's been?
Right. And, right after that, we went through a Vietnamese boat people refugee crisis, where at first Canadian government did not want to welcome the Vietnamese refugees, and only a lot of people sort of came out and say, look, they're just human beings and we need to give them a refuge if they're running away from their country. And you see that right now. You saw that in Syria and Afghanistan. The Ukrainians, I would say, have it a little bit better because, dare I say, they're white European origin, so maybe they might get a better treatment from Canada. But certainly our country has a fairly racist history way back, way back to 1920s when we had the Chinese Exclusion Act, where Chinese were not welcome. That is also a very black mark on Canadian history. So we want to make sure that these things don't happen again.
And are those the poor history that we have there here in Canada, has that been recognized as much as it should have?
Not enough. Certainly, I think that more and more the textbooks and media have now kind of recognized that. But this is something, it's a long journey that we've been fighting since 1978. We want that, basically, like you said, we want to tell our own stories. And we want to make sure that these stories don't get, quote-unquote, whitewashed, excuse my pun. But, that they get equal footing with other contributions to Canadian history. And not marginalized into a minority population.
I'm fascinated with your ability to tell a story. You were born in Hong Kong, grew up in Singapore, Hong Kong, and in Japan. You studied and worked in engineering in the U.S., then immigrated to Canada in 1976. You'd gain a successful career in information technology. Your engineering career later brought you to Europe and in Saudi Arabia. You speak English, Japanese, French, as well as Cantonese, and Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
How much does your world travel inspire the curiosity it would take to have the ability to tell a story the way you do?
I think it has a lot to do with it, because I'm confronted with, facing or finding out people tell me stories that they. When I travel, I love to sit in a cafe and just talk to the local people. Some people find it strange. How come you're not on a tourist bus going to Eiffel Tower? No, I want to sit in the country and sit in a cafe and talk to people, or maybe a restaurant. But every time I do that, I would discover, amazing stories that people would tell me firsthand. And that kind of, in my mind, makes me believe that I can, really help them tell their stories. Hence, my first foray was the film 20 years ago, Chinese Restaurants.
Mm. By the way, I mentioned Cantonese. The book title, Have You Eaten Yet? That's akin to You Are Well in Cantonese, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very traditional, not just Cantonese, but traditional Chinese greeting among, you know, people would see each other in the morning and say, have you eaten yet? It's a greeting kind of like as in asking, how are you? Except that we're relating it to food. Maybe that came from the time when China had famine and not everybody would be well fed. So asking if somebody is hungry or not is in a sense of caring and showing, you know, that showing to people that you care. And I think that has come down to, you know, colloquially today as kind of the way that we would greet each other. I'm talking about 50 years ago now. We don't do that anymore in Canada these days. But certainly that's a very traditional greeting that and that just shows you how important food is in Chinese culture. And just as equally, you know, the way we take food in, you know, it's always a very communal experience. You know, if you go to any of the dim sum restaurants in Chinatown on Sunday, you'll see tables of 10, 12 people, you know, a whole family together, or a bunch of people, friends getting together. You never eat alone. You know, you always eat by multiples of, you know, 10, 12 people. and that's part of the kind of a communal kind of ritual that Chinese go through when they eat.
I haven't even asked you necessarily about Chinese food and where you get the best Chinese food. You found that the best Chinese food is in Madagascar. It only took about 20-some-odd minutes, but I had to get there.
You have a national audience here, so I don't want to kind of leave anybody out. No, I mean, my rule of thumb is that if you want a real, real good, authentic Chinese food, go to places where the Chinese eat, where you see good Chinese faces, or even menu that are written only in Chinese, then you know you have arrived.
That's a very, very easy tip. What makes Chinese food or Chinese foods authentic to you?
To me, it's more, you know, I have given up on defining authenticity in Chinese food because there's so much mix and hybrid and fusion these days. It's hard to even tell, you know, what was in ancient China, what was in modern China and whatnot. My measuring stick is that basically it's something that you were brought up with, you know, from home, from where you were. So to me, the food that I had as a child or in my younger days, you know, in Hong Kong and Singapore, are authentically Chinese. Just like somebody would say, you know, sweet and sour chicken balls is authentically Chinese American or Chinese Canadian, and I would agree with that. And I think there is no good definition. If every time you put the word authenticity in there, you have to say authentic as to what? You know, in Toronto, we have a luxury of having a lot of restaurants that are run by, you know, more recent immigrants and chefs that are brought in from Hong Kong or Taiwan or China, where you can say, yeah, that's authentic to what I've seen in Hong Kong. And I think that's about the only thing you can say, you know, is that this is authentic to the food in Hong Kong or authentic to food in Taiwan. Other than that, there is no, it's very hard to say, you know, what is authentic or what's not authentic anymore.
His new book is called Have You Eaten Yet? Stories from Chinese Restaurants Around the World. Chu Quan, my apologies that this wasn't a television interview. But I'm glad you settled for doing
it. Maybe you can be a TV host one day.
Well, one can only dream. Congratulations on the book, and I really appreciate you having this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, thank you. That was fun.